This is a continuation, of course, from our previous talk on Obadiah and The Empire Strikes Back. But now we're going to bring in some New Testament passages to connect it together. We're over 100 years out from a lot of the prophecies that we know and their fulfillment. What has happened? Has anything really happened? What are the trends or the historical trends? Specifically, what are the worldwide trends? And so before we get there, we need to give a little background, and then we'll get into some of the technical historical things as well. Some of the history might be a little dry, but hopefully it'll help point various ones in the right direction. And so the first thing we want to look at are, you know, what are the Antichrist requirements when we look in Scripture? We know that the Antichrist has to come from the fourth beast, has to come from Rome amongst his ten horns. We know that the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and there are seven kings. We know that 2 Thessalonians talks about it appearing after a falling away. Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 describes it as having a mouth speaking great things and speaks against the Most High, and it blasphemes. Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 also says it makes war with the saints. It casts down the host and it destroys the holy people. It thinks to change times and laws, and enforces the false worship of the beast and the image. Through policy and deceit, it shall prosper. It has power of signs and lying wonders, and that one's important. That one's interesting. Revelation 13 also says it performs great wonders. And Revelation 19 says that the false prophet worked miracles in order to deceive. And we know that the Antichrist's main identification point was that 1260-year period, that 42 months, that times and a half a time, that 3.5 years. And so now, having this background, let's look at what we know about Edom's identification. And a lot of this I got from the fourth volume. So if you read the fourth volume, specifically the forewords and the first chapter of the book, it gives you a lot of this historical, a lot of this background and the interpretation. But remember, as we said in the first part of this, Esau sold his birthright. That's what Christendom did. Christendom has sold their birthrights. And remember, we need to be specific about our symbols. Remember, the Edomites were not Babylon, but they were allies with Babylon. So if we keep that in mind as we go, we can help separate in our heads how or who these allies with Babylon could be. Also, the ecclesiastical heavens. This is from Isaiah chapter 34. It talks about the heavens rolling up together like a scroll. This is an Edom and Babylon cooperation. And remember, that's one of the things that Edom was judged for in Obadiah's prophecy and all those other prophecies about Edom. Brother Russell suggests that the beast was papacy. And I'm going to give something from an opinion pocket, just a little difference of a symbol interpretation. The two-horned beast, it had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. And one of the other possible interpretations for this could be that it had two horns like a lamb. In Revelation, the lamb is a symbol of Christ. So it claimed to be like Christ. It claimed to be like, it claimed to be Christian, but it spoke like a dragon. So it's a Christian entity, a Christian group, but speaking Satan's lies. And that definitively fits our Antichrist connection, but also Edom as well. So what other group claims to be Christian, but it's not papacy? And would they be against God's people? We're going to talk a little bit about that as we continue. Now, Brother Russell also suggested that the image of the beast and the false prophet was the Protestant vitalization, or a union, or the authority that Protestant churches lack. And so I think Brother Russell's right with his interpretation here, and we're going to go and look at the trends of history to see if Brother Russell was right with his suggestion or wrong. And we'll get into that history in just a little bit. And remember, what does Jesus do? He judges the beast and false prophet in Revelation 19. And Edom, the false prophet's thrown in, and the beast are both thrown into a lake of fire. Well, where does Edom meet its end? In a lake of fire. I remember what we were talking about in that first part of this talk was all the symbols about Edom, they all are very, very similar. It's the same reasons. It's the same timing. They even meet their same end. And so by comparing that to what we know in the New Testament, we can see a connection here between Edom and the false prophet. And one of the, another connection is, Brother Russell suggested that Edom was related to the Protestants. Well, he also suggested the false prophet was related to the Protestants. And so you have Edom as Protestants, you have the false prophet as Protestants, and they're both there at the same time in the same battle and meeting their end in exactly the same place. And so if we were to simplify it down, it seems to be a very mutual cooperation, a very similar symbol. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, Jesus and the bride are going to judge the kingdom of Edom. The lamb is there on Mount Zion with 144,000, and they're judging the mountain of Esau. That means at the time the church is complete, Edom has a kingdom. So let's look at the historical trends and see how that fits or doesn't fit. We'll look at that here shortly. So let's go back through Obadiah and just do it real quick. This verse in Obadiah 1:3 and also Jeremiah sounds a lot like the great harlot Babylon and similar to the king of Tyre who symbolized Satan. Revelation 18:4 says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out over my people so that you will not participate in her sins and receive any of her plagues. For our sins have piled up as high as heaven. And God has remembered her offenses. Pay her back even as she has paid. And so if you remember the first part of this talk, that's exactly almost the same exact phrases that's used for these prophecies against Edom, for these prophecies against Babylon, for these prophecies against these nations that were against the chosen of God. And they're in the cleft of the rocks and in the heights of the habitation. They're in the mountains. They're using their political alliances. And you can see that this group wants a political alliance, almost a theocracy. You can see what Babylon did, what papacy did during the 1260 years. They made it a theocracy. And there are some of those who want to bring that back. As we said, there are those who thought they had safety in the heights, that they had the high ground. But the Lord is going to bring it down, and he's going to use his chosen people to do that. And so Jeremiah 49:16 and Obadiah 1:4 mentions that they might set their nest among the stars. And so if you remember in Revelation, the stars in Revelation are the leaders of the church. In Revelation 12, it talks about a dragon casting a third of the stars down to earth. Why are they setting themselves up in this position? They want to assert that birthright that isn't theirs or isn't their right to take. Their doctrines make them believe that it's their right to rule the nations. And the fallacies of their theology is what lifts them up. But also, it might be the cause of their demise. If anyone wants to align themselves with it, just like Edom did with Obadiah, going to find out it's probably not going to work. It'll cause more problems than they think, and they'll go after their enemies, and hopefully their enemies won't include us. The time of the end began in 1799, at the end of the French Revolution. And 1878 was a judgment on Babylon, and we were to come out of her. But she wasn't destroyed yet. Babylon wasn't destroyed yet. 1914 saw another judgment on Babylon, but still, she's around. And around the First World War, the Protestant church devised an idea of how to get involved in politics. And what led me to this conclusion is Revelation chapter 16. I had some questions about Revelation chapter 13, and because of the questions I had on that chapter, for years I had given up on any idea of a church-state cooperation. And I went around asking various brethren what scriptures did they have to suggest that such a thing was possible. And one of those that was, well, I was given types. You can never prove anything with a type. And we'll talk about some of those types later on. A type could support a doctrine or something that you already have a scripture for, but indeed a foundational scripture or scriptures. And so Revelation chapter 16 is the one that made me think. Revelation 16 talks about the dragon, beast, and false prophet aligning themselves with the kings of the earth and bringing them to Armageddon. Are they thinking there that they can rebuild the old Christian empires? Are they thinking that they can do conceive or work out the plans that they have? But when you look at what and where Revelation 16 is going, and into Revelation 17, Revelation 17 talks about the kings of the earth turning against her, just like Babylon turned against Edom. And the kings of the earth there kill the harlot, they burn her up with fire, and they eat her flesh. And this is the beginning of her judgment and the end, where the 144,000 with Christ are going to judge that kingdom of Esau, the kingdom of Edom. Obadiah 1:8, as we mentioned before, says, cause the wise men to perish from Edom and discernment from the mountain of Esau. Prophetically, I think that could mean that there a possible cooperation between church and government isn't going to work. And as we proceed through this talk, we're going to find that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And we'll get into the details of that in a little bit. In Obadiah 1:11, it talks about strangers taking his wealth captive. And, of course, that's parallel to what's going on in Ezekiel 38 and 39, when they come to take a spoil. And Joel chapter 3, verses 2 to 3, talks about casting lots for the people, for his people, and taking silver and gold and taking it to their temples, their idolatrous temples. Edom here is not only drunk on her own doctrines, but she's aligned with a harlot against the people of God. Now I'm going to pull something again out of the opinion pocket. When looking at different things, we also need to find out, you know, when we want to find out where we are in the stream of time, we need to find if there's possible fulfillments or possible interpretations. And so I'm going to give an opinion, but I'm going to give the opinion of a Jewish Christian that I thought was very interesting about Ezekiel chapter 38. Again, Ezekiel 38 talks about Gog and the land of Magog and coming against the people of Israel. And Ezekiel 38:10 says, it will come about on that day that thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil plan. And you will say, I will go up against a land of unwalled villages. I will go against those who are at rest and that live securely, all of them living without walls and having no bars or gates, to capture spoil and to seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited, and against the people who are gathered from the nations, who have acquired cattle and goods, and who live at the center of the world. Jeremiah 49:31 says the same thing. Arise and go up against a nation which is at ease, which lives securely. It has no gates or bars. Now, this note that this is, they're going to turn their hand against the people of the Lord. They're going to turn their hand against Israel. Could this possibly be in the process of fulfillment? And so there's a book written by a Christian commentator who is Jewish. It's called Epicenter. And he quotes from the modern Israeli military about what they think about their military might. And I'm going to read from pages 68 to 69 and page 72. It says, unless or until Iran gets nuclear weapons, Israel today is more strategically secure than at any other point since our birth. Major General Yaakov Amadir, former head of assessment for Israeli military intelligence, said unequivocally. So this is the Israeli military opinion. By way of explanation, he pointed to a number of specific developments. The Soviet Union has collapsed. Saddam Hussein and his regime are gone. Yasser Arafat is dead. Israel has a formal peace treaty with Egypt. Israel has a formal peace treaty with Jordan. The Syrians are withdrawing from Lebanon. Israel has a strong, well-trained, well-equipped army. Israel has the most advanced and effective air force, not just in the region, but in the world. Israel's Arrow missile defense system is steadily improving. And through better intelligence, targeted assassinations of Palestinian terrorist leaders and operatives, the security fence around Gaza, and the partially completed security fence in the West Bank, Israel has become increasingly successful at stopping suicide bombings and other attacks. Between 2001 and 2005, terrorist attacks dropped 70%. And the United States is a strong and steady ally and has a forward strategy against terrorists and state sponsors of terrorism in the Middle East. Israel's economy is healthy and growing. And when I talk against those who worry about Israel's security, Amador, again, this general, an observantly religious Jew, told me, I pull out a copy of my Bible and say, ultimately, we have security in God. Now the second quote, and this is from page 72. Lieutenant General Dan Halutz said that ironically, Israel was now enjoying one of the most secure seasons in its modern history. I believe that our strategic reality at this moment is the best ever for the state. When I look about, I find it difficult to see an Arab coalition rising against Israel. There's no unifying interest today for the Arab nations as there was in the past. And so the suggestion that they're making by quoting from the Israeli military is that this puts Israel in a position of being in a land of without walls, bars, or gates, because their military is of course their defense. Now, another parallel passage to this could be Zechariah chapter 12, verse 7. And there it says, Yahweh will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem will not be magnified above Judah. Why does he save the tents of Judah first? Because tents are not fortified. They don't have walls or bars or gates around them. And so perhaps this is indication, a very strong indication, that it'll teach Israel and the nations surrounding Israel. Remember, the lesson of Armageddon is for both, not just for Israel, but also those who attack her. That he saves the tents of Judah first, those that cannot defend themselves, so that it shows that it was a miracle that only God could have done it. But again, this is from my opinion pocket. We'll continue. Verse 14. So, question. If the John the Baptist story is a true type, and remember, it's more of a type of a type, could this relate to the Edomites of Obadiah's story and the other prophecies about Edom and what they did to the Jews? Remember, Herod not only killed John the Baptist, but he was also an Edomite. And so the suggestion some brethren make is that John the Baptist losing his head could be the way that the last members of the church will meet their end. Could the Edomites be a part of this? So we'll talk about that in just a little bit more. Obadiah 1:16 talks about drinking on the holy mountain. And this helps us understand again that it's a prophecy about what's to come. It's the day of the Lord. It's a shadow of things to come. Judgment begins at the house of the Lord. The bride and church are being judged now, but mankind's judgment is still future. There was a judgment on Babylon in 1878, but the harlot still needs to be destroyed and burned up, and her allies. Verse 16, again, with the same theme, these spiritual Edomites, these Protestants, have a similar pride as Babylon, and it too will be silenced by the Lord. Lamentations 4:21 says, "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz. But the cup will come around to you as well. You will become drunk and make yourself naked." And so both the literal and prophetic here shows that Edom will not get what they thought. They'll be defeated in the end. Now the smelting house here. If we remember the Elijah type and the 3.5 years drought, which is a symbol of, you know, the 3.5 years that the church was in the wilderness. I'm going to read from the January-February 2003 Herald magazine. It says, Ahab's first interaction with a prophet was when Elijah announced a 3.5 years drought. Immediately afterwards, Elijah had to run for his life and hid in Zarephath, a city belonging to Sidon of all places. While Jezebel was killing the prophets, Ahab feverishly searched for Elijah throughout Israel and all the neighboring kingdoms. Interestingly, Ahab worked closely during the drought with a certain Obadiah, not the prophet, a very faithful man who saved and fed 100 prophets of God during this time. Yet even Obadiah feared being executed by Ahab. Should he promise to find Elijah and not deliver on it? And that's from 1 Kings 18:10. And so again, if we think of that relating to our time and how it might apply to us, I think Brother George Tabak in his talk on Obadiah, he said that we realize, pictured Elijah, pictured the true church going into the wilderness condition during the 1260 years from 539 to 1799. It was a time of the 3.5 years of no rain, picturing that drought for spiritual truth. Why was he sent outside to Zarephath? To show us how the true church had to go outside the nominal church systems in order to be fed spiritually. And the last verse, of course, again, just to repeat again, you know, that's how the prophets did it. They told you what they told you, and then they told you again. And so again, here we have a mountain in prophecy as a government. And it's the mountain of Esau being judged at the time the church is complete. And remember, the Edomites were not Babylon, but they were allied with Babylon. So who and what are the Edomites, and how do they cooperate with Babylon? We're 100 years out from the start of the harvest, beyond that. So has anything happened in the past century that might help us where we understand and know where we are on the stream of time and what we should look for? So the Catholic Reformation, back to the Antichrist, they came up with some ideas why they weren't the Antichrist. And one of them was the preterist idea. And the preterist idea was that Nero was the Antichrist. And so they tried to limit all prophecies to be fulfilled by 70 AD. And so if all prophecies were fulfilled by 70 AD, the papacy didn't exist at the time. And so therefore the papacy's not the Antichrist. Another idea they had was the futurism idea. And the futurism idea is, you know, the rapture idea, the left behind idea. The idea that it's one man in the future. And so if it's one man in the future, again, we're not the Antichrist, it's somebody else. But the Counter-Reformation, the Catholics also had another idea. The idea that the Antichrist was with us for centuries. And this was their Jewish conspiracy. And today, we call that a lot of people call that the deep state. None of this is true, of course, but this Judeo-Masonic conspiracy. It's this idea that they think that we're not the Antichrist, but it's a Jewish cabal that has been with us for centuries plotting world domination. And so this futurist idea, this Judeo-Masonic idea, has been really developed from the late 18th to early 19th century. We'll get into the history of that and also John Nelson Darby, and we'll show the progression of thought and how it went forward. But again, these are tied into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. If anything is tied into an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, it's a safe bet. Toss that one aside. It's not true. It's Satan trying to blame the chosen people of God, trying to target the chosen people of God. And so we'll get into that in a little bit more. And this is a piece of artwork that I tried to create to show what they believe about this anti-Semitism. They believe that Jews are conspiring to take over the earth. That's why I have the map back there. And that they're trying to make a one-world government or a one-world currency. And so papacy's anti-Semitism, let's try that again. Papacy's anti-Semitism started very early. They blamed the Jews for killing Christ. At the Council of Nicaea, they tried to separate Christian practice from Jewish practice. They changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. They moved away from the Memorial Supper, away from Passover, and they shifted towards the emerging Easter festival. And so from that point onward, the developing Catholic Church increasingly defined itself against Judaism. For centuries, Jews were restricted in nearly every part of Europe. They were barred from owning land often, from inheriting property, joining guilds, or even holding public office. Many regions prohibited Jews from practicing most trades, forcing them into money laundering or pawn work, applications that Christians later used as proof of alleged Jewish greed. Canon law repeatedly reinforced their subordinate status. Jews had to wear a badge, just like they did in World War II, in the Holocaust. They had to live segregated in ghettos, basically. They had to pay special taxes, and they had to accept humiliating limitations designed to remind them of their supposed guilt in the death of Christ. The Third Lateran Council and the Fourth were regional synods throughout Europe that codified this discrimination against the Jews. The popes issued bulls that alternated between protecting Jews in order to preserve their economic order and restricting them even further at the same exact time. Papal rhetoric frequently portrayed Jews as being spiritually blind, cursed, or perpetually guilty. By the Middle Ages, anti-Jewish legislation, church-sanctioned ghettos, brought book burnings, including the Talmud, and periodic expulsions. That was the dominant Christian order against the Jewish people. And this helped shape European anti-Semitism for more than a millennium. And it provided the ideological foundations for that later political movement, both Catholic and secular, and how they would exploit it, how they exploited the Jews. So this idea that rich Jewish bankers were conspiring to take over the world comes from this period, comes from the Catholic Church. And it relates to the fact that they forced the Jews to be money lenders because Christians were forbidden by canon law to charge interest. And since most trades, land ownership, and guild membership were closely related to the Jews, money lending became one of the only legally permitted occupations available to them. But over time, this developed a reputation of the Jews. Christian rulers, nobles, and clergy became financially dependent on Jewish lenders. And this dependency created resentment against the Jews, especially when debts became due, right? Rather than acknowledging economic realities or the church's own restrictions is what created the problem, they blamed the Jews themselves and portrayed the Jews as being exploitive, manipulative, or secretly powerful. Modern preachers and theologians have transformed a structural economic condition one engineered by Christian law into immoral accusations against the Jews. They claimed Jews controlled money, enslaved Christian borrowers through debt, or sought dominion through finance. By the late Middle Ages, these themes solidified into anti-Semitic myths, Jews as wealthy financiers, as international conspirators, or as puppeteers of kings. And these tropes have continued into the modern era. And so you can see here a list of common anti-Semitic tropes. The Jews are greedy or money obsessed, they claim. They are secret controllers of world events, puppet masters, that deep state, conspiratorial elites. They are subversives, communists or socialists. Christ killers or religious betrayers. They're the enemies of religion. They're corrupting or decadent. They don't have the same morals that we do. They're disease bringers. Or they have a dual loyalty. You know, they can live in one country, yet they have a loyalty to the Jews instead. These are all anti-Semitic tropes, and none of this is true. And, of course, you have the replacement theory that it's a demographic threat, that they're trying to dilute the gene pool or bring in, change the voting pool through immigration. And these have been tropes about the Jews for centuries, and they just keep getting modernized and reused even in our modern day. And you have evangelicals that are real supporters of Israel. We'll use Pat Robertson as an example. Pat Robertson was one of the leaders of the Christian Broadcasting Network, and he said, Israel is a chosen people. They're the chosen nation. He says, we evangelical Christians oppose anti-Zionism. We love Israel. And he even said, I made a vow that we and those associated with us would stand with Israel and the Jewish people. Now, when I've talked to various brethren about Christian anti-Semitism, the first thought that comes to mind is replacement theology. You know, we're the Jews, and that the Jews have no part in prophecy or any promises at all. And of course, that's not true either. They are spiritual Jews, but it's an addition unto the real Jews. Remember, Paul asked the question in Romans, has he cast away his people? And he says, God forbid. But Protestants have these anti-Semitic ideas baked into their theology, into their doctrine as well. So while it's ironic that at the same time they express love and support for Israel, they can also be anti-Semitic. How can this be? Well, let's look at Pat Robertson's anti-Semitic comments. He says, Jewish people are very thrifty. They're good business people. This is that common anti-Semitic trope that the Jews are moneymakers. They said that Rabbi Lapin, he said, the rabbi should be busy polishing diamonds, not fixing his cars. Pat Robertson said, American Jews and Freemasons have embraced the New Deal and the Fair Deal and incorporated them into Judaism. And to me, they're not a part of Judaism. And so Pat Robertson separates in his head, there's good religious Jews that we want to support, and there's evil Jews conspiring to take over the world. He's anti-Semitic at the same time as he's Zionist, which is almost a contradiction in terms. Pat Robertson said, I would humbly make two requests of our Israeli friends. First, don't commit national suicide. It's hard for your friends to support you if you make a conscious decision to destroy yourselves. And so the rapture believers, these Christians, had this idea in the back of their heads that there's good Jews and bad Jews, and the bad Jews are the ones that they think are a part of the Antichrist. And they call them deep state or globalists. And they link the Jews into this Masonic conspiracy. So there's one of which neither of which is true. So other Christian authors, Martin Luther, said that synagogues should be set on fire. They should be forbidden to exist as Jews. Another one said communism is Jewish. Another said the Antichrist will be a full-grown counterfeit of Christ. Of course he'll be Jewish. That was Jerry Falwell Sr. Hal Lindsey, author of The Late Great Planet Earth, said unbelieving Jews will rebuild the false temples and offer false animal sacrifices. The Jews will be forced to accept the idolatry of the Antichrist. Timothy LaHaye, who wrote the Left Behind book, said some of the greatest evil in the history of the world was concocted by the Jewish mind. Sigmund Freud, Marx, These were Jewish minds that were infected with atheism. Why? Why did they use this coded language? European bankers or socialists or communists or globalists. Why did they use this coded language? And yet are referencing Jews or these anti-Semitic tropes? Well, Timothy LaHaye, in his book Rapture Under Attack, said, and remember, he's the one who wrote the Left Behind series. He says, I myself have been 45-year student of the satanically inspired centuries-old conspiracy to use a government, education, and media to destroy every vestige of Christianity within our society and establish a new world order. Having read at least 50 books on the Illuminati, I'm convinced it exists and can be blamed for many of man's inhumane actions against his fellow man during the past 200 years. And even beyond that, because remember, these Masons didn't even exist up until recent years. And so they're basically saying the Jews were the ones behind all of this. And that's why they leaked the Jews into this. So in the 1960s, this John Birch Society started. And it came out of McCarthyism. And if you remember, the followers of Joseph McCarthy, they thought they were finding socialists and communists everywhere. Joseph McCarthy ended up being a disgraced Wisconsin senator because he claimed he were finding deep state communists in all parts of government and military, only to find out they were targeting innocent people, and they were targeting Jews. A good percentage of those they accused in the military were Jewish, and yet they claimed to be Christian and targeting Jews. So the first two books that came up on this subject, one was written by Augustine Barruel, and he basically was claiming that it was Jews that was conspiring and making this conspiracy for centuries to make it a new world order. John Robinson was a Protestant, and John Robinson talked about economists. And by economists, he mentioned that they were Jews. And so he was baking into his conspiracies that this was all anti-Semitic. And of course, none of this is true. I've recently written a book on Henry Ford and some of the other, even evangelical Christians, have written a little history about where these ideas came from. And if you want to know a little bit about it, you can email me and I'll give you a little more detail. But none of this is true. It's all baked into their theology. It's baked into their rapture concepts. And so if we now come to compare Edom and the false prophet. And I have about 5 more minutes here. Revelation 16 talks about the beast and the false prophet. And Isaiah 34 talks about the heavens rolling up together as a scroll. Remember, Brother Russell suggests that the Edom and the false prophet is related to Protestantism. And Jeremiah 49, again, makes that distinction. It's not the people, it's the government, it's the kings and princes. Obadiah 1:21 says it's the mountain of Esau, their government. And again, they all end up in the same place. They are there at the same time. They end up in a lake of fire. They're destroyed in the same way. And so when you compare the false prophet with Edom, they're in the wine press. Garments are stained with blood with the Messiah. They're slain with a sword. There's these evil birds. That's not only in Revelation 19, but also in Isaiah 34. The remnant of Israel is rewarded, and so is those who refuse to take the mark. And again, they're destroyed in exactly the same place, in the lake of fire, and their smoke goes up forever. There's a direct connection to show that they're exactly the same thing. Now, there's 7 Armageddon requirements, and probably even more. 1, the fig tree. Israel has to be in the land as a restored nation. So any interpretation we look at, if we're looking before 1948, before Israel as a nation, we should be cognizant that Israel needs to be in the land. When we look at those contexts, Israel's in the land and they're a nation. Jerusalem needs to be under Israel's control. That happened in 1967. They need to be dwelling in peace and safety without bars or gates. And remember, I pulled something out of my opinion pocket on that. There needs to be a dragon, beast, and false prophet cooperation. And I think that's related to Christian nationalism. Now, the question is it on the right or the left? Well, Christian nationalism on the left is a contradiction in terms. Throughout history, Christian nationalism has always been on the right. But we're going to show now through the history. I'm going to go through the history of that and show how that is. And we're going to skip a couple slides here just to get there. And so here's a big timeline that we're starting with. We're going to take what we know so far. We're going to take the events that have happened historically, and we're going to compare it to how it leads to the final battle of Armageddon. And you can see the kingdom over there on the other side. And so we do know the French Revolution, 1799, was the end of the 1260 years. That was the earthquake. But we also have the Albury Conferences in 1829. Now, the Albury Conferences were a bunch of Christians who got together and decided, hey, the French Revolution just happened. There looks like there's a fulfillment of the 1260 years with what happened to the papacy. And out of that, they decided a few things. They thought that one of the things they thought that is the 1260 years ended there, but also that the restoration of the Jews must precede the time of trouble and all of the judgments of which it's composed of. They also suggested that the presence of Christ was invisible. And they linked that invisible parousia, that invisible presence, with the restoration of the Jews. And so in these lectures were compiled into a book called The Dialogues of Prophecy and published in 1828, 29, and 30. There were three of these. The second volume, it says, it is the restoration of the Jews, which is the outward and visible sign of the invisible resurrection of the bodies of the saints. And so there, the visibility of the saints to each other, but not to the world, is that which we are told to take place at the time that our blessed Lord himself arose. So it says he in like manner, after his second advent, will remain invisible to the world, but only be manifested at the grand crisis of his ancient church. And how could they know? He says in this book that it would be at the restoration or the national resurrection of the Jews. And so linking the resurrection of the nation of Israel to this. Now what preceded all of that out of the Albury Conferences was Nelson Darby brought a theology that moved beyond the Civil War. Remember, the Civil War is going on at this period. He thought the big thing was missions. And Darby decided that the rapture doctrine that he was promoting, this invisible presence, remember, those who believe in the rapture believe that it's an invisible presence. So when I talk to those who don't believe the way that we do, or they believe in the rapture, I try to start out with an area of agreement. We agree the coming of the Lord for his saints is invisible. They just have the coming back with the saints after the marriage supper as visible. And that's where we start to talk about differences. And so at least opens the door to start at an area of agreement. But Moody, Dwight Moody, who started the Moody Bible Institute here in Chicago, had this anti-Semitism. He prayed over the Confederate dead. He had a sympathy towards those in the South. After he died, the president who took over Moody was a man named Amzie Clarence Dixon. And it was his brother that wrote the book about the Klansmen. That book about the Ku Klux Klan, and it became a racist film that was created in 1914. Shortly after that, Dr. James Gray was the next president of the Moody Church. And Dr. James Gray was promoting a forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, claiming this Jewish conspiracy. Now, last year, we went to an anti-Semitism seminar at Moody Bible Institute, and Moody was talking about how pro-Zionist they were from the very beginning. And I went to Dr. Rodelnik there and said, hey, what you're saying is entirely true, because in the Moody Monthly magazine, they were promoting this anti-Semitic hoax. And his response was it was a little upsetting. He said, who told you this? Well, no one told me that. It came up in the research that I was doing. And his response was, yeah, Dr. Gray was anti-Semitic. And as we've seen, Pat Robertson and those others were as well. But remember, they separate in their head. They think there's evil Jews and good Jews. But the evil Jews part is where they think the Antichrist is going to come out of. And out of Moody, some of the authors were authors of the Scofield Bible Notes. And Moody and the Scofield Bible Notes, they came up with this idea. And remember, it's around the First World War. So if you look at this chart here, you can see French Revolution was a big change in culture. You had the Civil War. You had the First World War. You end up having the Second World War. And each time there's a change in Christian thinking. Scofield's Bible and Moody took what Darby had said. And Darby said, well, if the world's going to be destroyed, let's stay out of politics. Let's let it go. But their ideas was, let's get involved in politics and try and prevent what's going on. And so the whole thinking of these Christian evangelicals, the fundamentalists, changed to try to start getting involved in politics because of this theology. In the 1920s, you had another anti-Semitism. You had James Gray, Dr. Gray, who was leader of the Moody Bible Institute. You had Henry Ford. And you had the fundamentalists. And they were bringing in this non-denominationalism. So if you look at a lot of churches today, you'll see a lot of them are non-denominationalist. They're not the Lutheran Church anymore, or the Baptist Church, or the Christian Church. That started here in the 1920s. And that was a Moody Bible Institute idea that they spread throughout the world. And of course, in 1948, you had the return of the Nation of Israel. But out of that, you had this McCarthyism that I talked about earlier. And out of that McCarthyism became the John Birch Society. And the John Birch Society were a lot of Christian evangelicals who were spreading anti-Semitic theories about the church. And out of that society came the Dallas Theological Seminary. And out of that, you have a lot of names that you know, like Dwight Pentecost, Frank Schaeffer, John Volvoord, Chuck Swindoll, David Jeremiah. They were part of this Birch Society and spreading these ideas. Again, spreading love about the Jews, but at the same time, in their head, understanding that they thought the Jews were part of a worldwide conspiracy. Now, the next item I have on my list here is 1980. Was 1980 a pivotal year? Well, on the screen, it says the heavens rolled together as a scroll. Well, what do I mean by this? Well, Isaiah 34 says, all the hosts of heaven will rot away, and the sky will be rolled up together as a scroll. All their hosts will also be withered away as a leaf that withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. So what does this mean? This is a prophecy about Edom. And Brother Russell and several of the brethren, I was talking to Brother Ed Winsky about this recently, and he said, you know, this started in 1980. And I was surprised. Why would you say 1980? Because before that, you had Catholics and Protestants separate. They couldn't work together. And in 1980, what the Protestants did is they took up a Catholic idea, the Catholic idea of this anti-abortion movement. And they decided to cooperate with the Catholics on it so they could get political power together. Before 1980, the evangelicals could care less about the abortion issue. In 1971, the Southern Baptist Convention said that it was a Catholic issue and that they agreed that there are certain scriptures that would allow abortion. They changed in 1980. They switched from the Democratic side, the evangelicals and fundamentalists, to the Republican side. And they started to cooperate together on this issue. The heavens were rolling together as a scroll. It was no longer a Catholic issue. And so this idea, this evangelical idea spread throughout the world because of the Left Behind series, because of Campus Crusade for Christ, because of the missions. These evangelicals of America spread their ideas throughout the world because of their music, because of their bookstores, because of their books. Their ideas have spread so worldwide that now Christian nationalism is a problem in multiple countries throughout the world. And in the 2000s, we have just a couple minutes here. Sorry about that. In the 2000s, you had another idea from the charismatics. The charismatics believe that they have to invade Babylon through what they believe is a seven mountain mandate. And the seven mountain mandate, we'll get to in just a little bit, but we have the sixth church here, and the sixth church talks about the earthquake and the heavens being split like a scroll. Well, we saw that started with the Albury conferences. And as we continue into the seventh church, the sixth plague, you have the beast in the image, this church and state cooperation working together. Remember, the dragon, beast, and false prophet are bringing themselves to Armageddon. And then, of course, we have the Parousia, the Gentile times. In 1917, we had Allenby and the Balfour Declaration. Israel became a nation and Jerusalem was captured. And in 1980, we had this church-state cooperation. This adultery, this spiritual adultery of trying to align themselves with the kings. This idea is so pervasive. It's spread in dozens of countries around the earth. In Germany, the Christian nationalists won 40% of the vote in the last election cycle. This is now becoming popular in even France, which is a very secular nation. And we have, of course, now Edom and the beast, that mountain being judged and thrown into the lake of fire. And so one of the plagues, one of the things that they're being judged for is that they committed sexual immorality. They align themselves with the kings of the earth. And so we had papacy do that. We have Protestants doing that. And if you look at this chart here, this is basically a chart describing all those other things, but it shows things that are happening together at the same time. And so you can kind of get a visual picture of things that are happening so you can understand. Well, if we have deliverers on Mount Zion, we have Edom there being judged, we have birds in Ezekiel 39 and birds in Revelation 19, it's a safe bet they're happening at the same time. These are the seven mountains. And so the seven mountains that the evangelicals are now promoting, these charismatics, is that they have to conquer seven mountains of government. If they can conquer education, that's why they're so involved with trying to protect education, media, entertainment, business, family, and government. Well, why religion? Their idea about conquering religion is to remove the denominational boundaries between papacy, between all the denominations, so that they can bring about their ideas and bring them together. So how might the last remaining members of the church be taken up? So this is the last couple of slides here. In 1933, the German Christian nationalists persecuted the Bible students because they were Zionist. Hitler came to power January 30th, 1933. The primary targets of the Nazis within a few days of Hitler coming to power were Jews and the Bibelforscher, Bible students. Why Bible students? It's not because of Jehovah's Witnesses' neutrality. It's because Hitler understood that the Bible students were Zionist, that they loved Israel, that they believed in a homeland for Israel. And so the Jews were targeted, the Bible students were targeted because they thought they were part of a Jewish Masonic conspiracy. It even gets to the point where both Rutherford and Van Amberg write a letter to the Nazi party, to Hitler, saying, we're not a part of a Jewish Masonic conspiracy to take over the world. And yet that's exactly what Watchtower was believing at the time. So if you ping me after, I can get into the history of that and why that is. But let's go into the opinion pocket. We talked about the Elijah type. And that type of civil or secular power, trying to corrupt that religious power and, aligning with Ahab the king. We talked about the John the Baptist type, but also Israel's treatment by Edom. And so these are possibilities of my opinion packet again, of possibilities of what could take out the last remaining members of the church. But I like what Brother Grugin was talking about. He said, avoid foolish questions and genealogies. Reject foolish and ignorant speculation. And avoid those who devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. And this is what I'm suggesting. Stay away from these tropes, these anti-Semitic tropes, and especially if they have a relation to anti-Semitic tropes. And if you have differences of opinion with each other, we need to reason with each other. We need to find that sweet spot. We shouldn't need to have to fight to win an argument. Let's talk to each other. Let's not get that supremacy, but let's, again, find that sweet spot. Let's state our positions clearly. Let's find the underlying thinking. Let's find the history behind those things. Let's test our perspectives and inquire into the perspective of others. And one thing I liked about Brother Carl is he would always talk to brethren, and if they had a different opinion, sometimes he would give them a scripture or two that would support their position. That would help disarm them, to at least show that you're listening, that he understood what they were trying to say. And then he would say, but on the other hand, there's other scriptures that might go against that. And so that you could open up a reasonable dialogue. So as Brother Grugin said, reasoning together is hard work, but it's something that's vital. It's something that's crucial for our spiritual growth. Remember, if we're to make our calling and election sure, we want to help restore mankind as kings and priests. We need these skills to be able to reasonably work with many who are not reasonable before God's kingdom begins. So back to where we started. The wilderness and solitary place will be glad for them. God's mercy and grace will abound to any who will take that opportunity in the kingdom when it's presented to them. The time when God's judgments will be in the earth, in the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness, and the time when the Spirit and the bride say, come, and whosoever will, come and take the water of life freely. And I'd like to close with the Isaiah 35 psalm from our cap books. And may the Lord add his blessing.